June 26th, 2009. McCleary, Washington. After stopping by a friend's house, 10-year-old Lindsay Baum leaves to make her 10-minute walk home. Lindsay never arrives and is soon reported missing, but a massive search effort fails to turn up any trace of her. 8 years later, skeletal remains are discovered in a remote area over 150 miles away, and DNA testing eventually matches them to Lindsay. Even though the investigation turns up a couple persons of interest, including two local residents who provided false information about their alibis on the night Lindsay went missing, no one has ever been charged with her murder. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and we've got a pretty sad and heartbreaking story to cover today. The 2009 disappearance and death of Lindsay Baum. Lindsay was a 10-year-old girl who went missing one night on what should have been an uneventful 10-minute walk back to her house. This would become one of the most heavily discussed missing children's cases of the past decade, until skeletal remains belonging to Lindsay were discovered in a remote area 8 years later, and she was positively identified in May of 2018. I have received numerous requests from listeners to cover this case, both before and after Lindsay's remains were found. Everyone was hoping this development would soon lead to the case being solved, but here we are nearly 1 year later, and we still don't know who was responsible for her abduction and murder. Over the years, there have been a couple persons of interest who have done suspicious things to capture the authorities' attention, but thus far, no direct evidence has been found to arrest anyone. Surprisingly, even though this is a highly publicized case, the only time I've seen it covered on a podcast was on Nancy Grace's show last year. I've decided to cover this story now because Lindsay's case will be reaching its 10-year anniversary in June, and hopefully, there is a resolution sometime in the near future. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, we shall now explore the unsolved death of Lindsay Baum. Our story begins in Washington State in 2009. Our central figure is 10-year-old Lindsay Baum, who lives with her mother, Melissa Baum, and her 12-year-old brother, Josh. Lindsay was originally born in Tennessee, but after her parents divorced, Melissa decided to take her two children across the country to Washington for a fresh start. They ultimately settled in McCleary, a small logging town of just over 1,500 people, located in Grays Harbor County, about 80 miles outside Seattle. The family has spent the past 2 years living in a house on Momsen Road. Even though Lindsay hasn't seen her father, Scott Baum, for over a year, they often communicate via telephone. Lindsay is known for being a very talkative, outgoing girl who loves writing stories, and once stated that her dream was to publish enough books to completely fill her family's bookshelves. On June 26th, Lindsay was celebrating her recent completion of the 5th grade, and greatly anticipating her 11th birthday, which would be occurring in less than 2 weeks on July 7th. That evening, Lindsay decided to go to the home of her friend, Michaela, to ask if Michaela could stay over at her house. Her brother, Josh, tagged along with her, but after they left, the two siblings got into a heated argument over the usage of Josh's bicycle. A family friend soon intervened and sent Josh back home to cool down, while Lindsay continued to walk to Michaela's residence on Maple Street. After she arrived, Lindsay asked if Michaela could spend the night at her place, but Michaela's mother said no. At approximately 9:15 p.m., Lindsay left to walk back home, but even though the half-mile trip should have only taken about 10 minutes, she never arrived. By the time 10 o'clock rolled around, her mother Melissa became concerned because this was ordinarily Lindsay's curfew. Lindsay tried calling Melissa's cell phone to check on her, but discovered that Lindsay had left it at home in the charger. When Melissa phoned Michaela's house, she was surprised to learn that Lindsay had already left nearly an hour ago. After a quick search of the neighborhood failed to turn up any sign of Lindsay, Melissa dialed 911 to officially report her daughter missing. It would turn out the last confirmed sighting of Lindsay was from a neighbor who was on their way to work and saw Lindsay walking on Maple Street near 6th Street, the approximate halfway point between Michaela's house and her own residence. Over the course of the next week, law enforcement would coordinate a massive search effort for Lindsay, involving ground, air, and water searches, and agents from the FBI office in Seattle were brought in to assist the investigation. But unfortunately, they failed to turn up any trace of Lindsay. Right from the outset, police discounted the idea that Lindsay ran away on her own, as she left all of her personal belongings, including her cell phone, behind at her house. In addition, Lindsay also had a fear of staying out after dark, so if she had decided to run away, it seemed very unlikely she would have done so at that time of night. The most likely explanation was that Lindsay was the victim of an abduction, though a search of her computer turned up no evidence that she had been communicating online with any strangers who could have harmed her. However, Melissa would recount a pair of incidents which took place in the week prior to Lindsay's disappearance that may have suggested someone was stalking her. Lindsay told her that she and one of her female friends were inside the bathroom at a local park when a man suddenly burst in on them before leaving and taking off on a bicycle. Later that week, Lindsay shared an incident where she felt that she and her friend were being followed by a man in a white car. On the very day before she went missing, Lindsay also told her mother that she had an ominous feeling that something bad was going to happen, but didn't provide any specific details. Over the course of the next decade, over 40 people would be considered potential persons of interest in Lindsay's disappearance, but a couple of them stood out. The first person was a 23-year-old man from the nearby town of Elma, who has never been named publicly by law enforcement. If you search hard enough, you can find his name online, but since his name was not officially released, I will simply refer to him in this episode as DG. Anyway, at the time Lindsay went missing, DG worked at a retirement center located on Maple Street, near where Lindsay was last seen, and he first popped up on the police's radar because a witness had seen a white sports car with a loud exhaust on Maple Street that night. DG drove a white car with a loud exhaust, but an acquaintance of his told police they hadn't seen DG driving it through town like usual in the weeks following Lindsay's disappearance. Investigators called DG's home and left a message with his mother that they wanted to arrange an interview, but a strange incident occurred shortly thereafter when Melissa Baum contacted the police to report that she was being followed by a white car. It turned out the driver was DG, who told police he thought Melissa's vehicle might be suspicious and connected to Lindsay's disappearance, so he had decided to follow it. Upon further investigation, police learned that on the day after Lindsay went missing, DG had told a female acquaintance that he could not believe a girl from his area had been abducted and dismembered. It also turned out that 9 years earlier, when he was just 14 years old, DG had been accused of attempting to rape a 12-year-old girl, though no charges were ever filed. DG's initial alibi for the evening of June 26th was that he was working at his second job at a youth camp, but his supervisor told police that this was not true, because DG was under a 2-week suspension at the time for misbehavior. DG later changed his story and claimed that he had spent the evening at a neighbor's barbecue before he went home and passed out sometime after 9 p.m. A search of DG's cell phone record showed that he had used his phone in excess of 50 times for texting and calling on June 26th before all activity suddenly came to a halt at 9:26 p.m. The phone was next used to receive a 2-minute incoming call at 1:11 a.m. and not used again until 6:12 that morning. This was very atypical for DG, since records showed that there was usually constant activity on his phone every day until midnight or 1 a.m. Anyway, investigators thought there was enough probable cause to search DG's property, but no evidence could be found to link him to Lindsay's disappearance. It would be over 2 years before another promising person of interest popped up on the radar, and this time, his name was released publicly. The person in question was Tim Hartman, a local merchant who also happened to be a volunteer firefighter. Hartman and his wife ran a store called Hartman's Jewelry and Repair, which happened to be located at the corner of Maple Street and 4th Street, and would have been passed by Lindsay on her route home. On the night Lindsay went missing, Hartman actually became involved in the search when he bumped into Melissa Baum at around 1 a.m. and even went so far as to help Melissa look for her daughter by driving her to a creek Lindsay was known to play at. But investigators became suspicious when Hartman claimed that McCleary Police Chief George Crum had personally asked him to assist with the search, a claim which Chief Crum did not recall. But the biggest red flag turned out to be the inconsistencies in Hartman's alibi that night. Hartman produced a certificate to show that he had traveled about an hour outside McCleary to attend a class in the town of Belfair. Hartman claimed that the class ended at 9 p.m., which would have placed him outside of town at the time Lindsay went missing, but investigators learned that the class actually ended at 8:15. Furthermore, they also discovered Hartman in some surveillance footage from a local convenience store called Mike's Market, located just a few blocks away from where Lindsay was last seen, and timestamps showed him making a purchase and leaving at 9:19 p.m. In his original statement, Hartman made no mention of ever having been in the store, but said that he simply did not remember being there. He denied any involvement in Lindsay's disappearance, and maintained that he unintentionally gave false information to the authorities. Regardless, these inconsistencies prompted investigators to perform a search of Hartman's home, car, and jewelry store, where they seized over 100 items, including rope, a fingernail, and some handwritten notes about Lindsay. Hartman also underwent 2 polygraph tests, and claimed that he was initially told he had passed before the police changed their mind and told him he actually failed. When Hartman took a second polygraph, the results were inconclusive. But in the end, no evidence could be found to implicate Hartman, and while he has stopped cooperating with police, they have not upgraded his classification from person of interest to suspect. Anyway, Lindsay's case would garner a lot of media coverage, and in November of 2009, she was even featured on the cover of People magazine when they wrote an extensive article about missing persons. Her disappearance had a devastating impact on the town of McCleary, and Grays Harbor County Sheriff Rick Scott would be quoted as saying, "It literally took the innocence of that community and erased it that night." But the ordeal would be especially difficult for Lindsay's family. Her father, Scott Baum, was a member of the Tennessee National Guard, and was scheduled to deploy to Iraq only weeks after she disappeared, forcing him to go overseas without finding out what happened to his daughter. Melissa Baum was so overwhelmed by the experience that she found herself unable to return to work and had to rely on her son's Social Security disability payments to support the two of them, but it eventually reached the point where she could not afford to pay rent and they were evicted from their home. Lindsay's brother Josh was a special needs child who suffered from Asperger's syndrome and felt immense guilt over the fact that he had gotten into an argument with his sister shortly before she went missing. As a result, Josh suffered from frequent nightmares and serious behavioral issues. In fact, when they tried to stay with a relative of Melissa's, Josh's behavior problems escalated to the point that the relative decided to lock them out of their house. By 2010, Melissa was forced to move into a motel room paid for by a local charity, and sent Josh to live with his father for a while until she could find work and a decent place for them to live. According to Melissa, Josh, quote-unquote, didn't just lose his sister, he lost the mom he knew. The investigation would hit a standstill for the next several years before there was an odd development in August of 2017. as a trio of elderly brothers with the last name Emery were charged with two counts of second-degree possession of depictions of minors engaged in sexual conduct. They were 82-year-old Charles, 80-year-old Thomas, and 78-year-old Edwin. The brothers, none of whom ever married or had children, lived together in a house in Seattle for over 50 years, but Charles was suffering from dementia and had been moved into a residential care facility. Charles's niece was her legal guardian and went to the house to clean it out, but she wound up finding a ton of disturbing material and notified the authorities. The house was described as being littered from floor to ceiling with such material as child porn, photos of girls being raped and murdered, sex toys, used condoms, and children's shoes and underwear. They also found manifestos Charles had written, in which he described the ritualistic and satanic sacrifices of young girls. It would later turn out the brothers had sexually abused their sister and other female relatives, and were suspected of abusing children throughout their entire lives. But here's where the connection to Lindsay Baum's case comes in. The Emerys also owned an isolated farmhouse in the town of Shelton, which had been occupied by another brother, Donald, who died in 2016 at the age of 85. A bunch of disturbing material involving the sexual abuse of children was also found there, as well as a missing persons flyer for Lindsay Baum. Since Shelton was located less than 20 miles away from McCleary, investigators looked into any possible connection between the Emery brothers and Lindsay's disappearance and performed extensive searches of their homes and property, but could not find any evidence they were involved. However, there was a bizarre side story to this development. It turned out that in 1987, the deceased Emery brother, Donald, had filed for divorce from his wife Sandra, claiming that he could not find her. The couple had originally been married in June of 1970 and separated after only 3 months, but no one could confirm having seen Sandra since then, and as far as anyone can tell, she has never resurfaced. Anyway, shortly after the arrest of the Emery brothers, there would be another unexpected development, which eventually led to tragic news. In September of 2017, a skull fragment was discovered by hunters on Manistash Ridge, a remote mountain ridge located in Kittitas County in central Washington state. It was sent to the FBI lab in Quantico, Virginia, and tested against DNA samples in their queue. After several months, they were shocked to find a match to Lindsay Baum's DNA, and in May of 2018, it was officially announced that the skull fragment had been positively identified as belonging to Lindsay, and that she was the victim of an abduction and murder. The location where her remains were found was approximately 150 miles east of McCleary and 17 miles west of the town of Ellensburg. It was described as being a remote, steep, and heavily timbered area with large cliffs and ravines, which was used seasonally by hunters. The Kittitas County Sheriff's Office performed an extensive search of the area for the rest of Lindsay's remains, as well as additional evidence which might contain the DNA of the person who killed her. The inaccessibility of this area made searching very difficult, and if anything useful was found, the authorities have never revealed it. Lindsay's family were left devastated by the news, as her mother always held out hope that she might turn up alive. It would be a month after the discovery of the remains before Melissa gave her first public statement at a press conference and commented about the person responsible for Lindsay's death. Quote, "The person is a monster, and I grew up teaching my children that monsters didn't exist. So now, when you tell your children that monsters don't exist, you are lying. Just keep that in mind. They do exist. They don't look like monsters. They look like your next-door neighbor. They look like the person who lives down the street or the person who works in your school." End quote. The Grays Harbor County Sheriff's Office have publicly vowed to find the quote-unquote monster who murdered Lindsay and hold them accountable, but for the moment, the case continues to remain unsolved. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So this is definitely one of the more highly publicized missing children's cases of the past decade, not to mention one of the most heartbreaking when it comes to the impact it had on the victim's family. I mentioned earlier that Lindsay's mother, Melissa, lost her job and her home in the year following her daughter's disappearance, and that's a tragic side story which often gets lost in the coverage of missing persons cases. When someone goes through the tragedy of having a loved one disappear and they don't receive any answers about what happened, it can sometimes be impossible for them to function or carry on with their everyday life. Unfortunately, even when your family is the victim of a crime, bills still have to be paid. Melissa Baum was so overwhelmed by the grief of losing her daughter, and so focused on the search effort, that she just could not return to work, and this led to her being unable to pay rent and having to rely on the charity of others to keep a roof over her head. There was actually a very interesting discussion about this topic on the blog at the Charlie Project website in 2010 about whether or not government programs should be implemented to offer financial assistance to families of missing victims, since it can often be very hard to support yourself while an ordeal like this is going on. Melissa's difficulty was greatly increased by the fact that she had to take care of her other child, Josh, who had Asperger's syndrome and required special attention. As you well know, Lindsay and Josh got into a fight over his bicycle on the way to Michaela's house, which led to him being sent home, and if that hadn't happened, Lindsay would not have been walking home alone that night, and her abduction may not have occurred. So you can only imagine the immense guilt Josh would have felt over this, which only exacerbated his behavioral issues and made him very difficult to handle. I can only imagine how grief-stricken one must feel if they have a fight or argument with a loved one who winds up being murdered or going missing, and that turns out to be your last interaction with them. I know that if you read online discussions about this case, you'll often see comments criticizing Melissa's decision to allow Lindsay to walk to her friend's house alone at around 9 o'clock that night, but I'm not going to do that, as I'm sure Melissa has been racked with enough guilt over it. Remember, McCleary was a small town of only around 1,500 people, and Melissa has even admitted that because it was such a quiet, peaceful place, she developed a false sense of security. I know the discovery of Lindsay's remains last year was an incredibly painful experience for her family, but I hope that finally being able to bring some of her remains home has helped them cope a bit. Anyway, the time when the announcement was made that Lindsay's remains had been identified was a crazy two-week period when a bunch of cold cases from Washington State were being solved, including the 1987 murders of Jay Cook and Tanya von Kylenburg, the 1986 murder of 13-year-old Jennifer Bastian, and the identification of the unidentified decedent known only as Lyle Stevick. Incidentally, both Lindsay's case and the Lyle Stevick case were investigated by the Grays Harbor Sheriff's Office, as Lyle's suicide took place just over 60 miles from McCleary. But the key difference between Lindsay's case and all these others is that it is not completely unsolved yet, because while she is no longer a missing person, the individual responsible for her murder has yet to be charged. It seems obvious that Lindsay was abducted during her walk home that night, and that it likely took place during a very narrow window of time when no one saw anything. It's still not clear how or when Lindsay was murdered, but whoever was responsible went to the trouble of traveling around 150 miles to dispose of her remains at a very remote location in Kittitas County. Since this is not an easy location to get to, that would lend credence to the idea that Lindsay's killer was familiar with the area. So on the surface, you might assume that the perpetrator was not from McCleary and was just passing through the area when they abducted her, but the most promising persons of interest in this case lived in the vicinity at that time. I know that Melissa Baum has claimed that Lindsay gave hints in the weeks prior to her disappearance that someone may have been stalking her, as there was an incident where an unidentified man walked in on her and her friend while they were in the ladies' room at a park, and at one point, Lindsay thought she was being followed by a white car. These incidents may not have any connection to her disappearance, but they cannot be discounted, especially since a white vehicle would factor into the investigation later on. Melissa also said that Lindsay told her she had an ominous feeling something bad was going to happen on the very day before she went missing. So was Lindsay withholding anything which might explain why she felt this way? Did she suspect anyone in particular of stalking her? If so, then it seems more likely that the perpetrator was a local resident rather than an outsider. Well, over the years, there have been three particularly promising leads regarding potential suspects in this case, so I'm going to talk about each of them. I guess I'll start with what I consider to be the least promising of these leads, and that's the three Emery brothers from Seattle. Even if it has no connection to this case, this is still a pretty horrific story, and I can't imagine how unsettling it must have been to search through their two homes and find tons of child porn and material related to the abuse of young girls. The postscript to this story is that because of his advanced dementia, Charles Emery was deemed mentally incompetent to stand trial, but Thomas and Edwin served 9 months in jail for possession of child porn. Since then, a number of victims have come forward to accuse the Emery brothers of sexually abusing them, but given their advanced ages and the amount of time that has passed, no other charges have been filed. But it remains to be seen if any of them ever cross the line into murder. The main reason they've been investigated for a potential involvement in Lindsay Baum's disappearance is because her missing persons flyer was found inside their residence in the town of Shelton, which is less than half an hour away from McCleary. And that house was registered to the fourth Emery brother, Donald, who has been dead since 2016. But other than the flyer, there's really nothing else to link the brothers to Lindsay. The most obvious issue with them being suspects in her disappearance is that they all would have been in their early to mid-70s at the time she went missing. It's certainly not impossible that an elderly person could abduct and murder a child, but their age does make it less likely. The presence of Lindsay's flyer is hardly definitive evidence they were involved, as it's not uncommon for twisted people such as the Emerys to sometimes have an unhealthy obsession with missing children's cases. As an example, you might recall the episode I released last summer about the disappearance of 4-year-old Michael Dunahy, who went missing from British Columbia in 1991. Many years later, a deceased Milwaukee man named Vernon Seitz was looked at as a potential suspect because Michael's missing poster was found in his home. Like the Emerys, Seitz had a collection of child porn, and he had material from a lot of other missing children's cases. He was particularly obsessed with the 1989 abduction of 11-year-old Jacob Wetterling, and on the surface, seemed like a promising suspect, but Jacob's remains were eventually found, and it turned out his killer was an entirely different suspect, and Seitz had no involvement whatsoever. While Seitz was clearly a disturbed individual, no conclusive evidence has ever been found to suggest he was responsible for the murders of any children. The same logic might apply to the Emery brothers, as they clearly had a lot of sick fantasies about harming children, and I could see them developing an obsession with Lindsay Baum once her disappearance became a big news story in the area. Overall, I'm inclined to believe they had nothing to do with Lindsay's murder, though if it turned out that one or more of them had committed murder at some point in their lives, I wouldn't be the least bit surprised. I am intrigued by the bizarre mystery within a mystery involving Donald Emery's wife Sandra, who seemed to vanish without a trace in 1970, before he decided to file for divorce 17 years later. Since Donald has passed away, and I haven't seen much follow-up in the investigation to find Sandra, I'm not sure we'll ever learn the full truth about what happened there. So now we'll focus on the two local residents who have been looked as persons of interest in Lindsay's disappearance. Tim Hartman, who lived in McCleary, and D.G., the 23-year-old resident from the nearby town of Elma. These leads seem a lot more promising than the Emery brothers, but while Hartman has been publicly named as a person of interest, D.G. has not, which is why I'm only using his initials in this episode. One of the reasons investigators became suspicious of these men to begin with is because they both provided false information about their alibis on the night Lindsay went missing, and it's up for debate about whether they simply misremembered their whereabouts or deliberately lied. Let's start with Tim Hartman, as on the surface, there does seem to be good reason to believe he might be responsible. He originally claimed he was in another town attending a class which did not end until 9 p.m, and since this town was nearly an hour away from McCleary, this could have eliminated him as a suspect. But then investigators discovered that Hartman's class actually ended at 8:15 and spotted him in some surveillance footage at a McCleary convenience store at 9:19 p.m. Hartman never mentioned anything about stopping by this store in his original statement, and since it was located only a few blocks from where Lindsay was last seen, and she went missing during this approximate time period, it's easy to see why Hartman would have wanted to lie about his alibi if he was guilty. You can actually watch the surveillance footage of Hartman purchasing a bag of chips and an energy drink inside the store on YouTube, and a number of people have found it odd that he turns his head to glance out the entrance several times while paying for his items, and they believe he appears to look nervous. While this is taking place, there's also a white car parked right in front of the entrance, which might seem significant since Lindsay had reported being followed by a white car prior to her disappearance, but since the car drives away before Hartman exits the store, it obviously did not belong to him. But the fact that Hartman turned to look outside so many times has created speculation that he may have already had Lindsay inside his own vehicle at that time and was keeping an eye on her. However, I have my doubts that's the case. Think about it. If Hartman had abducted Lindsay, why would he stop at a convenience store to purchase a bag of chips and an energy drink? Even if Hartman had simply offered Lindsay a ride home and she was waiting for him inside his vehicle, it still makes no sense for him to stop and go into a public place where witnesses could potentially place them together. Also, Hartman's class in Belfair ended at 8:15. It takes around 55 minutes or so to drive to McCleary, and he was captured on the surveillance footage at 9:19. So I think that if Hartman was involved in Lindsay's disappearance, the abduction wouldn't have occurred until after he left the store. This footage does place him in the area at the time she went missing, so he easily could have crossed paths with Lindsay within minutes after he left. Now, I can give Hartman the benefit of the doubt that he simply misremembered some details, such as the exact time his class ended, or that he stopped off at a convenience store on his way home. That's the tricky thing with alibis. If you're guilty of a crime and wanted to fabricate an alibi, you're going to want to remember specific details to account for your whereabouts. But if you're completely innocent of a crime, the day on which the crime took place is just going to seem like another ordinary day, so you may not recall such mundane tasks as buying chips from a store. But the problem is that Hartman's day would soon become a lot more memorable, as he got involved in the search for Lindsay within the next few hours, and actually drove Melissa Baum around to help her look for Lindsay after crossing paths with her in the street. Hartman would also say that the local police chief asked him to assist with the search, a claim which the chief does not remember at all. If Hartman is guilty, you could interpret his interactions with Melissa as an attempt at misdirection, because he's helping her search a specific area where he knows Lindsay will not be. And while I can't 100% confirm this, I have read some rumors online that after this particular night, Hartman did not help with the search efforts at all, and rudely refused all requests to put up Lindsay's missing poster in his store. If true, that's pretty cold, especially since Hartman was flat out with the victim's mother while she was going through the ordeal of trying to find her daughter. There are definitely a lot of red flags with Hartman, but the complicating factor is that Lindsay's remains were eventually found in a remote area of Kittitas County, approximately 150 miles away. The timeline here is interesting, because driving to that location and back from McCleary would take approximately 5 hours or so. Since Hartman can be placed in McCleary at 9:19 p.m., and he bumped into Melissa at around 1 a.m., there's no way he could have made that drive on that particular night. But of course, if Hartman was responsible, he could have kept Lindsay hidden somewhere, dead or alive, and then transported her body to that remote location at a later time. If Lindsay was murdered by a local resident, it would definitely be in their best interest to dispose of her body as far away from the area as possible, and I would be interested to know if Hartman took any lengthy, unexplained road trips in the days or weeks following Lindsay's disappearance. In April of 2017, Lindsay's case was featured on an episode of the show Crime Watch Daily, which cast heavy suspicion on Hartman and showed him refusing to talk to them when the camera crew paid him a visit at his jewelry store. I think it's no coincidence that just over a month after the show aired, Hartman decided to close the store and relocate his business to another town, and if he's completely innocent, I do feel really bad for him. In an odd coincidence, Hartman's store wound up being relocated to Shelton, where Lindsay's flyer would be discovered in Donald Emery's residence only a few months later. Under normal circumstances, I would definitely consider Hartman to be the most promising suspect, but I now think the location where Lindsay's remains were found might point away from Hartman and incriminate the second person of interest in this case, DG. Even though he has never been named publicly by law enforcement, the reason I and many other people know his real name is because the probable cause affidavit used by investigators to perform a search of DG's property was posted in the Web Sleuth forum in 2009, so there are extensive discussions there about DG as a suspect. The affidavit contains a lot of interesting specific details about why DG popped up on the radar in the first place. Like Hartman, he initially provided a false alibi by claiming he was working at a youth camp on the night Lindsay went missing, even though he was on suspension at that time. So his new alibi was that he arrived at his home in Elma sometime after 9 p.m., watched some TV, and passed out, which is hardly airtight and cannot be verified. DG also drove a white car with a loud exhaust, which matched the description of a vehicle seen on Maple Street that night, and for reasons unknown, DG just seemed to stop driving it in the weeks following Lindsay's disappearance. This is particularly interesting, since Lindsay believed she was being followed by a white car the week before she went missing. Once DG learned that the police wanted to question him, he was caught following Melissa Baum around and claimed he did so because he thought her vehicle looked suspicious, which makes no sense whatsoever. And even though DG was constantly on his cell phone virtually every day during this time period, his cell phone usage came to a complete halt at 9:26 p.m. on the evening of June 26th, and aside from receiving an incoming call at 1:11 a.m., he did not use it again until after 6 o'clock the following morning. I mean, if DG is telling the truth, and he really did pass out while watching television shortly after he arrived home around 9 p.m., then this would account for his lack of phone usage, but it is quite interesting that all this activity came to a halt around the exact time period Lindsay was last seen alive. Of course, there's also DG's weird comments to his female friend the following day, where he made mention of a local girl being abducted and dismembered. But since neither the police nor the media publicly expressed their belief that Lindsay was the victim of a crime until a few days after she went missing, why would DG immediately jump to this conclusion and say something like that? DG's friend also said that he seemed to talk about the case obsessively during this time period. Well, here's the one piece of information from that probable cause affidavit which really raises red flags with DG. I know it's a cliche to say this, but when I read this tidbit, it made the hair on the back of my neck stand up. The woman whom DG said those remarks to was an old high school friend of his who had moved away from McCleary, and they were now getting back in touch for the first time in years. Well, guess where this woman lived? Ellensburg, Washington. As you recall, the remote location in Kittitas County where Lindsay's skull fragment was found was only about 17 miles west of Ellensburg. Not only that, but DG actually made a trip to Ellensburg to see this woman on July 16th, 3 weeks after Lindsay went missing. She told police that DG's car broke down and she had to drive him back to his home in Elma. Now, this detail about Ellensburg may not have seemed overly important back in 2009, but it certainly seems a lot more significant now, since it places DG in the area where Lindsay's remains were eventually found. In spite of this, law enforcement has never publicly classified DG as a suspect, but there do seem to be an awful lot of coincidences which link DG to this case. It's always been speculated that whoever disposed of Lindsay's remains had to be familiar with that remote area, since it's not the easiest location to get to. I mean, I'm not saying that DG knew this area well, but we do know he passed through there at some point. For all we know, if DG was the perpetrator, he could have kept Lindsay hidden somewhere near McCleary or Elma for the first few weeks, but knew it would be in his best interest to get her as far away from the area as possible. So when he went to visit his friend in Ellensburg on July 16th, he used this opportunity to transport Lindsay's body with him and went to a remote spot in order to dispose of it. But given that there are several hours when DG's whereabouts are unaccounted for after 9 p.m. on the evening of June 26th, it's not impossible that he could have taken Lindsay to Kittitas County that very same night and returned home by morning. I can tell you that during my research, I initially thought that Hartman was the most likely suspect until I came across that probable cause affidavit, which linked DG to Ellensburg. I'm not saying that I completely discount Hartman, as there are a few suspicious things about him which cannot be adequately explained, but he can be placed in McCleary in the hours following Lindsay's disappearance, and at no point can he be placed in Kittitas County. These same things cannot be said about DG. And while I see no indication that Hartman had any criminal record or a history of harming young girls, DG was once accused of attempting to rape a 12-year-old. However, it's worth reiterating that in spite of a number of suspicious actions on their part, both DG and Hartman were thoroughly investigated by the authorities and had their property searched, but no definitive evidence has ever been found to tie either of them to Lindsay's disappearance. If I had to pick one who I thought was a more likely suspect, I would probably lean more towards DG, but I guess it's still possible that Lindsay was abducted by an opportunistic predator who just happened to be passing through the area at that time, and this person is yet to show up on the radar. I think the key to solving this case might be the same thing which led to the resolution of the other Washington State cold cases I referenced earlier: genetic genealogy. Law enforcement performed a very thorough search of the area where Lindsay's remains were found because they're hoping to uncover any piece of evidence which might have foreign DNA on it. If they can find DNA which belongs to Lindsay's killer, then there's a good chance that using genetic genealogy might lead to her perpetrator. I definitely think this case is very solvable, and that law enforcement are very dedicated to finding answers. It will not stop until they have a resolution which can finally bring some full closure to Lindsay's family. So if you happen to have any information about the unsolved murder of Lindsay Baum, please contact the appropriate authorities. A tip line for the case has been set up at 360-964-1799. That's 360-964-1799. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email under the subject line Trail Went Cold Contest to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We've already produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this month, we've got a new episode about a very unusual case of alleged amnesia. It covers the disappearance of a man named Lawrence Joseph Bader, who vanished without a trace, but resurfaced years later under a completely new identity, claiming to have no memory of his former life. I also wanted to mention that we've implemented a brand new bonus reward for patrons in Tier 3, as I've recorded my own audio commentary track, which can be played over the very first Robert Stack-hosted episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I hope to record more of these commentary tracks in the future, so to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. I'd also like to take a moment to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon, and they are JW, Andrew S., Daniel N., Fiacra G., Heather S., Joanna H., Mandy G., and the No Friend or Thrash Show. Thank you all so much for your support. And you may have heard that for the third consecutive year, I will be representing The Trail Went Cold by appearing on Podcast Row at CrimeCon, which is being held at the Hilton Riverside Hotel in New Orleans from June 7th until the 9th. If you would like to purchase tickets to the event, but haven't already done so, we have our own personalized promo code you can use in order to get 10% off a standard badge. So to receive your 10% discount, please visit crimecon.com and enter the promo code COLD19. That's COLD19. In addition, I will also be appearing at another event, the True Crime Podcast Festival, being held at the Marriott Downtown Hotel in Chicago on July 13th. So to learn more information about this event and to purchase tickets, feel free to visit their website at tcpf2019.com. That's tcpf2019.com. I also just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online Forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week and join me next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. Thank you.